Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios at a crazy time that I don't understand this time warp thing and transmitting across the internet, this is episode 103 of Registry Matters. I got a question for you, Larry, but first, how are you tonight?
This afternoon, I'm doing fantastic.
Why do we choose to say O or zero, depending on cases? Are you a zero or are you a O person?
Well, they're two different characters. It depends on which you're using.
Well, for this episode, it's 103. Would you say 103 or 103?
Well, it would be correct at 103.
But which would you say?
Nobody in the right mind. It would be like the songs when they put in "He Don't Love Me." Like, I mean, correct is "He Doesn't Love Me," but try singing that. try singing that out.
There's this guy that I go to lunch with all the time, and he's like, "Well, yeah, my mom don't want nothing to do with that." I was like, "God, can you please not do that? Please, pretty please, please don't do that." Wait, who's that laughing? Larry, who's laughing? Do we have an intruder? Oh,
we do have an intruder. So let me introduce our intruder. We have Liberty and Justice Coalition's staff attorney, Ashley Raymore Cloud. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you. Sorry to intrude, but we have exciting news today.
We do. Hey, that should be my cue. Hang on, I'm going to do my cue. The exciting news is a stellar decision out of Illinois. Do you guys want to give a quick little teaser that we'll cover in more depth in a minute? What's going on in Illinois?
So we have a decision out of the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois that ruled that a probation condition, somebody on probation, cannot totally be banned from the internet.
Okay. Wow. That's it? That's a quick teaser for sure.
And they said that, and was it unanimous or was it a split decision?
There was one justice who declined to even get involved, but all the other ones did a unanimous decision. There's no dissenting opinion in this.
This is exciting. I can't wait to break it down in a jiffy.
Interesting. All right. I'm looking forward to it. I like glanced over the decision looking for keywords and such. But all right, so we will move on to some news items. What is this first article, this craziness that you have up here, Larry, about registered forever, New Jersey offenders fight for reprieve?
Well, I thought the article was relevant because I'm continually trying to illustrate for those who believe in their heart that they want textual interpretation of the law, that this is a case where we're going to get an interpretation from the High Court in New Jersey about what the law says. And the law specifically says exactly what the prosecution, what the state, not the prosecution, but what the state is arguing it says. It says that you have to be offense-free for 15 years before you're eligible to be removed from New Jersey's registry. It doesn't say sex offense-free. It says offense-free. Keep a clean record for 15 years. So I put it in here because our audience, which tends to lean toward the conservative side, they are always saying, give me judges that will merely interpret the law and not put their own spin on it. This is precisely the type of thing where this is not exactly what you would want, because if you look at the text, it says exactly what the state is arguing it says. And I'm going to let Ashley, she's got the thing, she's got the statute, but I pulled the statute. So what does the statute say in relevant part, Ashley?
So I believe.
Did I put it in your folder?
Yes, you did. Sorry. Okay. Had to get down to the part that it said. Except as provided in subsection G of this section, a person required to register in this act may make application to the Superior Court of this state to terminate the obligation upon proof that the person has not committed an offense within 15 years following conviction or release.
Stop right there. Quick. It says an offense. Did it say sex offense, Ashley? Did it say sex offense or did it say offense?
It just says offense.
Okay. Now, let's dive into this a little bit before you finish reading. With however many people serving in the New Jersey Assembly, if they had meant it to be sex offense free, Do you think they possibly would have enough brains to put that in there? Or do you think that they intended to leave it broad and wide open? But the court is faced in looking at this wording, and it says, has not committed an offense within 15 years. And that seems to be, if you're a textualist, you would be palpitating, saying, well, they're interpreting exactly, if they come down with a ruling, I expect they'll come down with, they're interpreting exactly what the letter of the law says.
At a very right. minimum, even if they wouldn't have put sex offense in there, you would think they would have put serious offense or related offense or some other language instead of leaving it this broad. Because as you know, offense can mean everything from murder to a traffic ticket. And that's a broad spectrum.
And there's an and it's not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others. But you don't get to that point if you have, because these people are arguing that we're fully rehabilitated and our offense was so minor and it happened a long time ago and we're not likely to pose a threat to others. But you don't get to that point if you've had an offense in the last 15 years. And in this article, they've had other offenses. So they're not eligible.
No, they're not. You never get to that second and. It's not or. It actually says and is not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others. The other thing that's interesting about this is has not committed an offense within 15 years following conviction or release from a correctional facility. So essentially, if you get to 14 months or 14 years and 11 months and 29 days and you commit a shoplifting, it doesn't even give you the option to start over again. You're just done. Whether you commit offense on day one when you step out of, and that could be, again, a traffic ticket, it could be larceny, it could be anything, but there is nothing that specifically says that you have to be 15 years offense free. It says within the 15 years following conviction or release.
And that's what one of the individuals is arguing, that at least a 15-year period should restart. But the law doesn't say that.
No, it does not.
Now, our audience, we don't want people who put on a black robe to legislate from the bench and create law that isn't there, do we?
No. There is a separation of powers for a reason. However, as I know you and I have had good discussions about this, that when it suits everybody's purpose, we want judges to legislate from the bench. But the reality is there is a statute for a reason, and the judge's job is just to interpret it. And if you are a textualist and you're not bringing any other language into it at all or thought process, which true textualism does, then it is within 15 years. And it is an offense, and it's left broad, but it's pretty crystal clear what they intended to do.
So, well, and then of course, if you are one who subscribes to something that late Justice Scalia found revolting, he referred to it as purposivism, you would look at the purpose of this removal process, and clearly you can derive that probably the purpose is to give people relief from the sex offender registry if they're not committing sex offenses after they have originally been convicted of a sex offense. I mean, you could deduce that. But again, purposivism is obnoxious to certain. They say that's just hooey. You know, the law is wherever you want it to be on any given day. But merely going by the text, there's no way the court can give these guys relief because they're not entitled to it under the law.
So to take that one step further, Larry, and I kind of agree with that premise, but I don't think it is just sex offenses. I think that if you went out and committed murder and they had just put sex offenses in there, but you killed somebody within that 15 years, then you could argue that, well, it said sex offense. It wasn't a sex offense. So I think they left it pretty broad for a reason. And again, what you're saying, if we want to look at what the purpose behind it was, then are we going to say no more sex offenses, or are you supposed to be crystal clear with zero issues for 15 years to the day from your conviction or release?
Well, that's what the law says, and that's what I'm predicting the court's going to find, unless we have a bunch of liberal activists on there who decide it's their job to save society from the will of the people is enacted through their elected spokespersons. But their elected spokespersons gave crystal clear guidance. After 15 years without any offenses, you're entitled to be to petition. And at that point, you get to show that you're no longer dangerous or a threat to the community. But they did not leave all that mushy, good feeling stuff. They didn't leave all that shoulder of opportunity for you. As far as I can see in the wording, it's very, very clear.
I think it's pretty clear. I think it's also interesting that they threw in the paragraph right below it too that says, except as provided in subsection G. And if you are acquitted by reason of insanity for more than one sex offense, you also aren't subject to this removal process. So it's an interesting statute.
So, well, now before the hate letters and emails and phone calls start coming, I didn't say that was my personal view. We're talking about judicial interpretation and about textualism versus purpose and intent. And I'm trying to help our audience understand that sometimes you think you're for something that you're really not. Once you get a little below the surface and scratch in and look a little deeper, what you thought sounded good may not be as good as what you thought it sounded.
Do you guys want to move over to the next shenanigans case of the week?
That's great, because it actually follows this same line of thinking. So let's do it.
All right. Well, yes, this next one comes from KWTX, and you almost have to be living under a rock to not have heard of this one within our circles. This is a mother in Utah being charged, may have to register as an offender after being topless in her home. The way that this story seems to go down is her and her husband were hanging some sheetrock or something maybe in the garage, and they, instead of getting dusty, like putting on some like utility clothes, they decided to get mostly naked. And so they were still wearing their bottom stuff, but they took off their top stuff. And eventually somehow the kids saw mom, and then I guess like Child Protective Services, whatever. Anyway, so she's being charged for being naked in her own home, or at least half naked. And you laugh, Ashley.
Well, I don't see any issue with it myself. I've looked up the Utah statute, and it's under lewdness. And we have it. We're going to make it in the show notes at 76-9-702. And it is very clear that a person is guilty of lewdness if the person performs any of the following acts in a public place or under circumstances which the person should know will likely cause affront or alarm to, or in the presence of another who is 14 years of age or older. So the question I would like to see in the charging instrument was, were these persons 14 years of age or older? But if they expose under subsection 1B, exposes his or her genitals, the female breast below the, what is that word?
Areola.
Or the buttocks or the anus or the pubic area. So if she took off her entire top, assuming that she is a born female. Now, of course, if she's transgender, she could say, well, I wasn't born female, so therefore this doesn't qualify. But if she was born a female, this statute, if she exposed her entire top, this statute covers that if those minors were over 14. So I don't see any problem with this. This is the law.
I don't think it's just the kids seeing her, though. The way this statute reads is pretty funny, because or in the presence of another who is 14 years of age or older, and you have exposing his or her genitals, the breast, etc., that's also her husband. So does that mean you should never be naked in your own home, in your own marriage? Because it doesn't carve any exception whatsoever
I didn't even think of that. Now, that's a good point. So you can actually be charged because over 40, it doesn't give an age cap. So it says 14 or older. So if you pull off your bra and expose that to your husband, then you have committed a sex crime in the state of Utah. Or yes. if you literally read this the way it's written.
Yes, if you read it exactly the way that it's written.
Now, but before I looked up the statute, when Andy told me about this last week, I said, well, this case is not going to go anywhere because this wasn't done in public. And people have the right to do what they want to in the privacy of their own home. And now, being that most of our audience is going to be against governmental intrusion, And we think the parents are always the best decider of what's good for kids, and it doesn't take a village to raise a kid. It's all about the individual. If a parent thinks it's okay for them to prance around the house with their tops off, who's the government to come in and say otherwise? So I was thinking, well, gee, this case is going to go nowhere, but that's not what the statute says. And go ahead, Andy. I'm sorry. I kept
going. Oh, no, that's totally cool. I start to then wonder about, like, it's obvious in our social culture, in, you know, for this country and other Western nations, not the United States, that there's nudity on television. You can see a man, you know, doing the morning run to the bathroom, whatever, and you will totally see like full on buttocks. People in the United States would lose their freaking minds if that happened in the United States. There's also breastises shown on television in other countries, and not in a sexual manner. The other question that I would like to kind of tie into all that, the United States, they lose their minds when a woman breastfeeds in public, even though she's not like exposing her breasts so much, but like this is somehow some sort of taboo action. Why do we have such a, this like, ah, when a woman's breast is shown, but we don't do that for guys? It's the same materials.
Well, not exactly. There are some anatomical differences in the equipment, but I get your point.
Hang on. I bet you Jared from Subway, after he lost all his weight, he was a larger cup size than most women.
But would you agree that the breast of a woman provides a slightly different function than a man?
I mean, as like a function as in nurturing an infant, sure.
Yes, yes, okay, yeah. Well, I don't think male breasts do that, for at least I'm pretty confident they don't.
No,
but
I believe
you're right. In terms of the size, yes, a man could have some pretty good size, depending on the size of the man. And I can answer my personal opinion. I think it has a lot to do with our Judeo-Christian values. I think that we have so spooked everybody about sex, and that sex is supposed to be between a man and a woman and in the sanctity of marriage. And I think that has something to do with an influence that other countries don't have. I mean, I think we have the highest practicing amount of Christians in the world. I may be wrong, but I think we do.
I won't argue with that one. The United States is roughly 70% Christian.
Yes, and I'm not saying for sure I know that for a fact, but I think that may be a fact. And within our legislative processes, they exert an enormous influence on public policy.
So Ashley, can you split the line there between as a woman and also an attorney? Why do we have this inconsistency that dudes can run around at the beach with their shirts off and women, by golly, cannot, even if it's just a tiny little piece of thread covering the nipples, that they can do it, and we like lose our minds over this?
It's puritanical. It's pure and simple. It goes back to the Victorian era where we view the female in certain areas of her body as more sexual than the areas on a male's body, and it's a male-run society. It's a sexist throwback to that. There's no other explanation for it. The funny part about all of that, and I'm not sure that it's very funny, is that we're talking about a Utah statute that is essentially saying you can't be naked in your own home. This is also the same state that does not, and I apologize to any Utahians, but it does not allow you to show Saturday Night Live and other shows that would actually show buttocks or anything else. They actually censor those things off the TV.
They don't do SNL in Utah?
They did not. And if they started doing it, it would be recent, because my parents used to live there and I would be there on Saturday nights going, why is Saturday Night Live on? Not on.
I have never heard of this. That's amazing.
I hadn't either, but so it does not surprise me that this is where this statute comes from. It does surprise me the level of what could be charged under this.
Well,
that's
crazy. It would be my view that there are some significant constitutional issues with this statute in terms of the Equal Protection Clause, the overbreadth, which generally gets argued in First Amendment and speech, but to have a statute that potentially regulates conduct in the home, I think you could stretch the overbreadth doctrine to include this. What do you think?
I agree.
Does she have a constitutional claim to equal protection, blah, blah, blah?
I think there would be a good equal protection argument on this, because it does say female breast. It does not say female or male breast.
So, yeah, our laws are supposed to provide equal protection, and this is clearly this particular subsection only applies to, you know, the breast of a female. So I think that clearly there's a protection issue there. That you would need to be able to explain why a female breast is so different. It would be like the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. If we had said that men could still drive 70 back in the embargo days and women could drive 55, to do that, we would have had an equal protection clause unless we had been able to show that there was some compelling difference between the driving skills and the safety of female drivers. And in fact, female drivers are statistically safer than guys.
Come on, so, man. Everyone knows that guys drive better than girls.
No, everybody doesn't know that because the actuaries don't bear that out.
That would be why male insurance rates are so much higher, especially up to the age of 25.
Yes, I actually think that has a lot to do with guys being show-offs and probably having a undeveloped brain.
And what is it, that enlarged
Google medulla oblongata? Yeah, I could play the clip for you. It's an amazing response you have for that, Larry. I love your response to that one.
Let's do it.
Oh gosh, it's put me on the spot. I just moved out of that folder too, Larry. Oh,
don't worry. It's all right. So
I got it right here. It feels to me like in many of these states, they are aggressive about this stuff because they have an enlarged medulla oblongata.
A what?
I love the way you say that, Larry. I love the way you say that.
Well, I still can't even say it after you've given me the word as many times.
tell me this, though, as far as, is it possible that she is like running this up the flagpole to actually try and get something changed? Didn't you say something earlier about an Abe Lincoln quote, Larry?
Well, she's not running up the flagpole. She didn't have any choice.
That's true.
Here's what's going to happen. Because the prosecution can't help themselves and they're going to go forward with this, she's going to force a constitutional interpretation because she has no choice. She can either accept a sex offense conviction or she can challenge the law. But she's not causing this. The prosecution is bringing the case. I mean, the defendants are just merely on the receiving end of this. And I always find it humorous when they say, why did this particular defendant have to take this case as far? Well, he didn't. You did.
Yeah.
Oh, you brought the charge. So the reason why this is going to be found to be unconstitutional, if it is because the state is unrelenting and they're determined that they're going to have their day in court and that they're going to do their duty as putting their hand on the Bible and that they're going to enforce the law as it's written. And so therefore, we're going to have a constitutional challenge and hopefully the Constitution will prevail and this will be stricken as being unconstitutional and overbroad.
And Ashley, I found an article from 2013 titled Saturday Night Live Moves to Salt Lake City's Mormon-owned NBC affiliate. Maybe in the last 6 years, somehow they got SNL, which is bizarre. Bizarre to me that they wouldn't have SNL.
Is that not bizarre that they didn't have it up until then?
Yes. And you know, then there's like pirate television, pirate radio, whatever, broadcasting that stuff for, quote unquote, those people to hear. That's bizarre. God, that's bizarre.
Yep.
Shall we move on over to this Illinois decision?
We should, because we have limited time with Ashley and she's got other responsibilities. So let's do this. So we are talking about a case that was just decided on Thursday. That's why it's late breaking news.
Woohoo.
And it is going to be, it's going to be a case that Ashley will not be able to contain herself on. And I am going to just say, Ashley, do you want me to ask you questions or do you want to just go ahead and give a synopsis of this state Supreme Court case first? So what is the case? What is it all about? What's the name of this case for those who are out there listening, haven't heard of it yet?
The case is the people of the state of Illinois versus Conrad Allen Morger. And he appealed this all the way up to the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois.
And I think you got choppy on that. The case name was what?
It is the people of the state of Illinois versus Conrad Allen Morger.
All right. So what was the case about, and why did he see the necessity to contest the law? Why didn't he just take his punishment and do what any good criminal would do and go on with their life and suck it up. So what's this case all about?
So Mr. Morger seemed just bent on asserting his constitutional rights to freedom of speech and not to be subject to probation conditions that are unreasonable, not rationally related, or otherwise vague. And so what he did is he took a bunch of probation conditions to the Court of Appeals in Illinois and stated that they were overbroad. And most of them were dealing with internet, social media, things like that. The appellate court said they were not overbroad, were not unconstitutional. And so he took it to the next level, to the Supreme Court. When he took it to the Supreme Court, all he was challenging at that point was that there was a provision in his probation, and it was by statute, that says that he could not be on any social networking websites. And the question before the Supreme Court was, is this unreasonable and unconstitutional under the First Amendment? Do you want to guess how it ends?
Yeah, how did this end? Because so we've got all over the country, we've got supervising authorities, either by policy or in some cases, such as in this case, by statute, saying you're not allowed. And I think our co-host was told in Pennsylvania that if you move here, you will not be allowed on the internet. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so we've got these authorities operating either with statutory language or by policies that they've promulgated or that they've just pulled out of air when they don't have either, and they're applying them across the board to everyone. What is it going to take for them to realize that you just can't do that? You would have thought Packingham would have been a wake-up call.
And that's what I love about this case is, so both sides are relying on Packingham, but they're interpreting it differently. They're both stating that it's a pivotal case. And the court said, yes, it is a pivotal case, but it's more than that. What Packingham said was that you can't have these blanket bans on social media and internet and things like that, but it did not refer to them being probation or parole conditions. It was referring to a North Carolina statute that says that you cannot do any of these social networking sites or anything else, if even after you're no longer on probation. And so that's what it ruled unconstitutional. This case takes it one step further and said, literally, what's the difference? If probation and parole is for rehabilitation and you're supposed to be reformed after it, what's the difference between being reformed and being rehabilitated? And this court said there isn't a difference. Those are the same things. So why can you have that condition for one and not the other if they both have the same purpose? And I thought it was brilliant the way that the court put that.
Well, I have been one of those who said, who have cautioned that Packingham, since it was only for people who had paid their debt to society, that you can't say that automatically it means that I, as a supervised offender, can do whatever I want to. I've said that, but also said the analysis that flows from it, because they used the language particular for people who've paid their debt or served their sentence in its entirety. I forgot the specific wording. But the analysis of how they got there was they talked about the town square and compared the internet they gave you the roadmap that said, if you're going to impose these very, very strict conditions, they better be narrowly tailored to a particular offender and not to a class of offenders, not to a broad section. And somehow or another, if I were running a probation department and I read Packingham, I would say, we've got to be very careful here, because we have a policy that says that everyone who's required to register, or even in our case in New Mexico, if you've even been charged with a sex offense and you pled it down, they put these conditions on you. And I would be saying, hey, wait a minute, we're going to have to be careful. We're going to find ourselves in court. But apparently nobody does that.
I was just going to say, Larry, you are giving them way too much credit for their thinking processes.
Well, I thought that your job was to stay abreast of the law, either through statute or case law, and to discharge your duties in compliance with the law, is what I thought a probation official was supposed to do.
And you're absolutely right on that, because under 1983 actions and color of law, it is one of the criteria that if there is a Supreme Court decision or some other case that tells you you can't do something and you continue to do it, it actually shifts the burden from the person who is challenging the condition to the probation or parole. So no. You would think that they would be more careful about that.
Well, let's just break this down a little bit for people who are not familiar with 1983, which is a vehicle in the federal system to use to bring a civil rights claim. And when you're alleging that a state actor has violated your rights, you have to show that it was clearly established. Well, a Supreme Court case, that usually would meet the definition of a right being clearly established, right?
Correct.
Okay, so when did Packingham come down? Was it 17 or 16? It's been a couple of 3 years ago.
I want to say it was 2017.
So I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, 2017.
Okay, so you've had 2+ years notice now, 2.5 years, because they usually come down late spring, early summer. So you've had 2.5 years notice. Law enforcement, you've had plenty of time to know that you cannot arbitrarily, capriciously restrict everyone from the internet. You know better, and you deserve to lose all the lawsuits that's going to come at you if you keep doing it. And we at Liberty and Justice, we plan to bring some against you here. So you need to be on notice right now. Those of you who are listening to us, and I know we probably have some law enforcement listening to us, we are coming for you.
That's a pretty bold assertion there, Larry.
but we're going to back it up. Mm-hmm. So we've already come from for them in one lawsuit, and we have several more on the horizon. And there's one thing that they've learned, hopefully dealing with me, that I actually do say and do what I said I'm going to do. We are coming for you, New Mexico authorities. We definitely are coming to you.
That is correct.
Why do they think they can do this exactly?
Oh, Larry, say your favorite thing. Why do they think they can do this?
Because they can until they're stopped.
Exactly.
And then it's just totally our job to make them stop?
Well, in an ideal world, Andy, we wouldn't have to make them stop. Ideally, when you put your hand on that Bible and you take the badge and you take the oath and all this stuff, ideally you would be getting up each morning saying, I want to stay within the contours of law. In an ideal world, that's what you'd be. But we're not in an ideal, perfect world. We're in a competitive society where people want to gain whatever advantage they can. And they believe in their mind, however distorted their mind is, they believe that they're somehow keeping society safe. And they're rendering justice to people who didn't get it. These people shouldn't be on the streets. The court got it all wrong. And by golly, I'm going to make their life as miserable as I can. And I can put them in jail. But see, unfortunately, that's not your job. You weren't the decision maker who got to decide that they were on the street. You're the official of the court in case of probation. You're the official of the court that's designed to execute the judgment of the court, which it was the court's judgment that they were supposed to be in the community receiving rehabilitative efforts. Rather than providing rehabilitative efforts and trying to guide the person to become a better citizen, you spend all your energy trying to wreck them and put them in prison so that they can be a burden on the society and so that you can have another feather in your cap that you took another bad guy off the street. And they invent this thing that they think that somehow that's their calling to do, which is not what they're supposed to be doing.
And you said they put their hand on what?
They put their hand on that Bible.
Okay, sorry, you didn't say it quite like that last time. I always get very much tripped up, and Ashley, please help, from your prosecutor hat wearing days, that like this is, if you know it's not within what you should be doing, do you believe that you're actually saving society and doing the right thing, even though, you know, blue letter law says you can't use a fork on Wednesday night to eat chicken? Like, I mean, you know, a prosecutor could go after that.
They could. And that's the distinction between what Larry was talking about earlier, which said that they take an oath that says, I will uphold the law, and versus what that oath actually is in New Mexico. And if it isn't in the other states, it should be. I take an oath to uphold justice and protect both the rights of the defendants and the community. And it's a balancing act. And if they did that, we wouldn't have these issues. But we know for a fact, Larry, that they don't do that, right?
Well, they do it in one county in this state.
Only one. Only the one I was in.
So, I'm going to ask you a few questions about the case, if you don't mind.
Okay.
So, the first thing people that are listening are going to want to know, okay, this is in Illinois. What does this do for me? I don't live in Illinois. I live in Ohio. I live in Florida. I live in Louisiana. And I've got the same problem here. And all I hear you people do is babble and babble about all this great body of case law. What does this do for me? What does it do for these people in the other states?
So while it is not binding case law, meaning the court has to follow it, this is persuasive case law. And on top of that, in most of these jurisdictions, they're reviewing this stuff de novo, meaning they're reviewing it as if it's the first time that they've heard it because there isn't good case law on it. This gives them guidelines because this took a Supreme Court case, a United States Supreme Court case, and put it in the context that it and extended it to people still on probation or parole.
Okay, so the people in Louisiana that are listening, which I know we have some that are under these horrendous restrictions, what would they do? Okay, so we've got a body of case law developing on this area of social media. So how do I get my state? How do I get this case before my state Supreme Court? I'm working for $8.25 an hour and I can barely pay all the costs that they've leveled on me. And I can't do any of this stuff. I can't go out and hire a lawyer. What do I do to get this before my Supreme Court? Where the hell is the ACLU? How are these people in Louisiana and all these other states going to get this up to their state Supreme Court to apply Packingham what do they do?
So there's a couple of avenues, and that's a good question on where the ACLU is. I actually believe the ACLU across the U.S. is working on stuff on these complete internet bans, so this might be a worthy challenge depending on the state. But even in absence of that, what this is going to take is somebody to be violated or have these conditions imposed on them, and they're going to have to stay the course. They're going to have to follow it through. They're going to have to, even if they do a pro se motion or the public, they have a public defender and the public defender gets involved and file something with the state court, whatever the level is, superior, district, whatever you call it in that jurisdiction, and then they're going to have to follow it up the chain. And it's going to have to be challenged, but it has to be challenged on people that are actually under these impositions. Which, interestingly enough, on this particular case, by the time this actually made it up to the Illinois Supreme Court, this particular defendant had served his sentence, and normally that would have rendered it moot. However, as an exception to the mootness doctrine, meaning that even though it doesn't technically apply to him anymore, it applies to others. And so the court gives an analysis and says, this is a question we have to decide. And that may be the case in the other states, too.
Well, and I noted that in the highlights, which will be available in the show notes. So starting on page 8, they go into the mootness doctrine. And I always tell people there are exceptions to the mootness doctrine. And there are exceptions where the public interest is significant. And this is an issue that needs an authoritative determination for future enforcement. And there's a likelihood that this will continue to repetition. There's these standards where you can mooting out a particular individual, that's a state tactic. They say, well, if I can just get rid of this person, who knows, they may let him off supervision early for all we know. But that doesn't, in all cases, that doesn't end a controversy because there are exceptions where you can keep the litigation alive. And that's what this happened. They said, too bad, this is an exception to mootness, and we're going to keep right ahead of analyzing. But there's a lot of highlights in the case we're going to make available. And I always call people's attention when there's a constitutional challenge. So on page 7, and in principles of review, I've highlighted all statutes are presumed constitutional.
Of course you have.
The party challenging the constitution of the statute has a burden of clearly establishing its invalidity. This court must construe the statute so to uphold its constitutional, if reasonably possible. So they start trying to uphold the statute because that's their job. Is to afford great deference to the will of the people. but they couldn't get there from here. They looked at this and they could not get there because it's just such an overbearing, overbroad infringement on people's fundamental liberty.
How much do you think the impact of the internet then weighs into this? I can't think of really another example. Is there, you know, like, isn't Illinois that has, they can't go to public parks and things like that? I mean, if this is a,
yes,
this is a freedom of expression challenge, if I'm not mistaken, right? And doesn't this then apply to that too? Or could it tangentially?
Maybe, but I would think we would have a harder time getting there. And the reason is because what this court is relying on is the Supreme Court has characterized social media websites as being the modern public square.
Right.
And that there are a lot of legitimate purposes for people being on social media, exchanging ideas, learning about stuff, furthering their rehabilitation, furthering their education, getting jobs. And all of those are way beyond any immoral or illegal purposes that they're claiming the social media, the only reason a person would use social media so they could be immoral or illegal. And that's not the case. So I'm not sure you can make that same argument with regards to parks, because there's some other things that they're considering on those. However, they do actually compare this case and use as a basis a juvenile case in which a juvenile was not allowed to travel to a particular geographic region. So with that being said, it might be able to be stretched to apply to parks and things like that if there is no legitimate purpose.
And that is about the case I was going to bring up. JW was what they relied heavily on the case of JW. And when they talk about the framework of JW, the considerations in determining whether the conditions are valid, they've got, and I've got these highlighted on page 17 of the decision, whether a condition of probation impinging upon constitutional rights is reasonably related to the goals of probation and thus narrowly drawn and not overbroad, include one, the nature of the offense, two, the rehabilitation of the defendant. Remember, probation is supposed to be rehabilitative. Three, whether the condition of probation reasonably relates to the rehabilitative purpose of the legislation. Four, whether the value of to the public in imposing the condition of probation manifestly outweighs the impairment on the probationer's constitutional rights. And five, whether there are any alternative means that are less subversive to the probationer's constitutional rights, but still comport with the purposes of conferring the benefit of probation. That's your framework in Illinois. If they throw conditions of probation on you, you can cite to JW and say, these are what the court's going to look at, these five, if I challenge your condition.
And that's exactly what they will. And I also made notes on that page too, Larry, because this to me doesn't just apply to social media. It also, within those paragraphs, applies to searches and travel, the geographical restrictions, things like that, that essentially what this is telling probation and parole, you better have a narrowly tailored probation or parole condition that will only be served by imposing this condition.
So people who are in the state of Illinois, you've got a fresh decision that affirms that probation does have limitations of what they do. And what could have happened here, since neither of us live in Illinois, this could be, I give some benefit of the doubt, this is a long stretch, but it could be that probation knew that they couldn't do this stuff. And it could be, well, by golly, we'll just put it in the statutory code and you will do it because that's what we want you to do. It could be that this condition that was imposed by statute was something that there could have been hesitancy by the probation authorities, and they could have said, hey, our hands are tied. And also conversely, they could have gone to the legislature and said, we want you to do this. I don't know, but either thing is a possibility. Either way.
That is true. And that should put states on notices that are not even under that statutory deference, that if you just have a behavioral contract or you're just imposing probation conditions and they aren't even statutory, you're going to have a tougher road.
That's what I say. Like New Mexico, you don't get any deference of a statute because we don't have a statute. The only thing you're going to get some deference on the statute is the statute on the GPS for people serving parole, because we're going to shoot your damn parole down altogether anyway because it's unconstitutional. But But in terms of this behavioral contract and all this slop that you're imposing on people, you don't get the deference of a statute because there is no statute.
Does this apply to other states directly?
I think it could. Again, it's persuasive case law, but it's like what we're talking about. There is a wave of cases coming down stating that enough is enough. You've gone too far. You cannot have these blanket bans just because you want to, without any reasonable relation to what the person is actually convicted of. And it, even if they're violated on probation or parole and it involves the internet, this case actually goes so far as to say that that may not even be enough either, that you really better have a good reason for having these kinds of impositions on somebody. And there could be examples or people that this could actually apply to, but it's going to have to be very, very narrow. And states need to take pause when they're both drafting or imposing these conditions.
And again, our side needs to be there holding up these cases. So we need to be in the arena saying, hey, well, you know, Indiana legislature, you can try that, but it got shot down in Illinois at the Supreme Court. In the same analytical framework, we're going to rely on Packingham here, and we're going to have a similar outcome here. Don't adopt this kind of stuff. But when these kind of things are going through, there's nobody there on our side. I mean, the law enforcement apparatus is represented by every entity that you can imagine, but our people are nowhere to be found.
So, Ashley, to go back to that, if someone were to want to move to another state, they just walk into their probation officer's building and say, here's the decision out of Illinois, you guys should comply? Smack them over the forehead with it, maybe?
Sure. And then when they call us from jail or they've been taken back to their state in handcuffs, then we can say how maybe that might not have been the best tactic. So again, it's going to take some challenges to it. It's going to take civil rights organizations. It's going to take challenges from NARSOL. It's going to take challenges from the public defender's offices. And I urge them to actually get involved at the local levels and start taking these cases up the chain, because it will never change unless we get that kind of buy-in.
And there's a little bit of dialogue going on in chat about this of, you know, in many states where they do have just outright bans on internet usage, you know, your crime could have been 100% in person, 0% online, possibly even like with an adult person, but they still have, you know, like there's a woman in Virginia that is on the registry because she didn't report her kid doing something naughty. Well, so she could potentially, I don't know if she does or not, but you know, if she were in Illinois, maybe she has an internet ban because she didn't report her kid doing the nasty with another kid. What about things not applying directly to your case?
That's what this case is about. In this particular set of facts in this Illinois case, the person was actually convicted of having sex with his sister. There was nothing to show that he talked to her over the internet, that they were in chat rooms, that they were on social media or anything. At best, all they could argue was that he viewed porn at some point on the internet. That's it. That is not enough of a rational, related, narrowly tailored condition. And yes, most states have a blanket ban. New Mexico has a blanket ban. It doesn't matter what you were convicted of. It doesn't matter if the internet wasn't even invented when you were convicted. It's essentially, there is a blanket social media, and that includes sites like OfferUp and LetGo that aren't even any closely related to anything having to do with a sex offense. So it's, these blanket bans need to be challenged. And I mean, we're about to challenge them here in New Mexico. So I'm hoping that other states get involved, especially with opinions like this coming down, because this gives a definite framework for doing that. It gives a solid basis and argument as to why you cannot have these conditions.
Larry, can we take a teeny little detour about the individual that brought this case? Did they have any, are they some like a known entity to us as the advocates for changing these laws, or is it just a lone wolf kind of person?
I don't know who brought the case.
So meaning no. And so then that leads me down a path of, how do we collectively, you know, the you people, how do we get known to more of our people? You know, there's 800,000-900,000 of us on the registry, and it seems like we would do better to fight these battles as a collective instead of a lone wolf.
Well, if we had the resources, if someone had reached out to me to NARSL, and ultimately it would have made its way to me, if someone had reached out to me and said, I want to assert this challenge, I wouldn't have had any resources to offer up to them. I don't have a staff attorney in Illinois. I don't have any money to throw around. So we run into the same problem we run into continuously. I don't even know if this was done through the public defender or if this was a privately retained. I don't know how this case was brought.
All right. And I mean, that's not any sort of dig. That's not my dig. I'm not trying to dig in. I'm just like,
But the answer to the question is, if we had gobs of money, we would staff up around the country, at least have regional staff attorneys, but we would have a legal operation in each state with people who were on salary, who evaluated and prioritized litigation, and we would be on top of this. The truth of the matter is, we don't have any paid staff. We don't have the ability to do all these challenges. So we're usually looking in from the outside, and we're filing amicus briefs. We occasionally have the resources to do amicus briefs. But New Mexico is the only state that has its own attorney, but no other state does. The national organization doesn't.
So bottom line is we need everyone to donate a dollar, and then we would have money to move mountains.
Well, I think we're going to need more than a dollar because of the enormity of the problem. But if theoretically all 800,000,
that's what I meant. That's what I meant. Everyone donate a dollar,
but
including Will.
But the thing is, yeah, but the financial barriers are enormous because these cases drag on for years. And those who've listened to the podcast for a long time, they hear me say this all the time. They devour a lot of resources, and the state has endless resources, and most individuals don't have those type of resources. So we end up without adequate. We can't match what they. So they can do more violations than we could ever challenge.
All right, then. Ashley, how long can you stick around with us?
I have a few more minutes. Larry, do you have more questions for me?
So, well, I think I covered the highlights, but you can certainly jump in here with any more advice to people, because this is such a significant thing when you're trying to work in 2019. You're trying to live a life where the internet is such a relevant. I mean, it's only the rare employer that you can actually go in and fill out a paper application anymore. I mean, you need to be on email. You need to be able, you just can't work in this day and age without. So this is a significant issue. And social media, it's kind of like the organizations where at one time you couldn't be a member of the Kiwanis Club if you were female. These social service organizations. You remember the Kiwanis, the Rotarians, mm-hmm. all these clubs. Well, a lot of businesses done, and those organizations were forced to open their doors because it just wasn't. And a society that prides itself on equality, it wasn't fair to exclude women from the opportunity to network. Well, it's not fair if we expect an offender to reintegrate in society and pay taxes and be a lawful abiding citizen. How is it that you can sit and say, well, we won't give them access to any of the levers of a modern society, and then we'll violate them and complain that they don't reintegrate into a modern society? How does that work?
That's exactly what that they're doing. And it's interesting because the state was asked how to explain the total ban on access to social media, which I'm sure you highlighted this phrase in this opinion. The state was asked to explain how the total ban on access to social media would contribute to a defendant's rehabilitation. The court actually says, after some circuitous, non-responsive references to protection of the public, the answer was that the ban would remove the temptation to reoffend. The answer might carry some weight where a defendant is one who had used social media to orchestrate and affirmably commit his crimes. But the thing is that, like what you're saying, you can't even get onto Google Maps without internet or going through what would presumably even be social media to try and find destination to your job or to even get to the probation office for the first time. I mean, there's just a whole host of ways that you need this. And they're overlooking all of that and going, oh, all anybody is ever doing on social media or the internet is
trolling for kids,
causing more crimes, mm-hmm. trolling for kids and committing new crimes. And I think it's also interesting that the court pointed out that there were other conditions that could achieve this, namely, don't commit more crimes. That would cover all these. So they don't have to have these blanket bounds. They don't have to have these probation conditions. They're just putting them in there.
Yeah, they can have a condition that you don't have any relationship with anybody who either is or represented to be below a certain age. And that can be narrowly tailored to those who've had who's had solicitation type offenses. If you've solicited a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old or whatever, I think it would be fair to say on social media, you cannot have any friends who are minors other than your biological children and maybe some extended family. But to say that you can't use the tool that everybody uses to promote family, I mean, people, everything is done on social media now. I'm old and antiquated, and I don't, but everybody has that's how they share their family photos. That's how they schedule reunions. I mean, that's how everything's announced on social media.
Yes. It's how I keep track of people's birthdays. It's how I find jobs. I mean, there's no way around it. And that's essentially what the courts are saying. You maybe 100 years ago, and we didn't envision social media, you could say, okay, you can't be on something that would allow you to have contact with minors. But that's not what they're saying. And they've taken it way too far. And I'm glad to see opinions like this saying you've gone way too far.
I have a reference to an article, I'll leave it in the show notes, from vice.com. And this is from December of 2018, where the reporter tried to quit the various big internet companies. And one of them, one of the sections in there is how to quit Google. And says, Google was without a doubt the hardest company to purge from my life. And, you know, just as you were just describing, almost everything that you do, even to the point of you'll try to hit a web page and there'll be one of those little goofy captchas. Most of those are provided by Google. If you purge Google from your life, you can't log into some large percentage of sites on the internet. And then you just described about using Maps. Google Maps by far kills everybody in their mapping. When Apple released their mapping software, it was atrocious at how bad it was. And it has since improved. But it's just like, you know, I don't want to use foregone conclusion, but to me, it's just a foregone conclusion that they just have the best piece of technology to do those specific jobs. And it would be ridiculously hard to get those things out of your life.
Yes, exactly. And that's what this is too. It's ridiculously hard to avoid all social media, all internet access, all computer things. Like I was telling Larry today, New Mexico has a provision in the behavioral contract that you're not allowed to have shredders. It doesn't say for employment purposes or anything else. So what happens if you have your bills and you want to shred them?
Or you get a bogus credit card in the mail. Hey, sign here and you have $10,000 of credit and you want to chomp it up. And
but somehow we should risk identity fraud just so you don't have a shredder.
I was just thinking about, you know, so somebody has survived the registry and they're more affluent and they go out and buy a Tesla, which is like, you know, an internet connected car. Does your PO say, no, you can't have that car?
That's interesting because most of the cars are actually now internet connected.
Correct.
Not even just Teslas, but I mean, most of the cars, anything after 2017 has internet connectivity or seamlessly integrates with your Apple or your Android or all things because it reads the little chips and stuff in it too.
Yes, absolutely. Crazy. All right. Well, then this is ultimately good news.
Well, Ashley, thank you.
I think it's great news.
Thank you for spending your Saturday afternoon part of it with us. And we're welcome to have you. You are welcome. We would welcome you anytime.
Yep, I agree.
Well, thank you guys and keep up the good work and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Thank you very much. Enjoy your animals.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, Larry, right. we should move over to this courthouse news article where it says judge wades into debate over conditions at San Francisco jails. These people, I've got to figure out a way to word that so it's the you people expression. They haven't had like sunlight in years, and there was something that said, this is just stupid to me that somebody would say that. Trying to remember, he said something like, hey, well, there's this artificial light that meets the standards. It's like, really? You went that far to try and say that artificial light is a good substitute for natural light?
Well, I didn't want to spend a lot of time on here, but I'll put this in for a sinister reason. I like to try to think of myself as somewhat fair, and this is in what's supposed to be an enlightened and progressive San Francisco, where they would be conscientious about human rights and about and here we are having this federal lawsuit and discussion about whether or not people need some natural light when they're locked up for months or possibly years on end without any. And so I just thought it was kind of neat. But it said the U.S. District Judge Sally Kim appeared skeptical of this claim. So it doesn't sound like that the judge is particularly sympathetic if this article is accurate. Why do you, again, Joe R. Pyle, former Sheriff Joe R. Pyle from Maricopa County, he took pride in treating the people less well than he treated the animals. He had the prisoners taking care of the animals, and he had the dogs ventilated and cooled off, and he had the humans out in sweltering heat. Why is it that we have to even have this discussion?
Is it fair to even make the claim potentially the dog didn't commit a quote unquote crime? The dog is just existing, and this is just where we have. We are forced to place them in lack of having housing for them. It would be, call it foster kids, so to speak. So you take someone that has committed some kind of crime, robbery, jaywalking, check kiting, whatever, and they have committed a crime, a willfully committed a crime.
Well, if you assume that everybody who's in a county jail has committed a crime, if you jettison the presumption of innocence, then I guess you could make that quantum leap. But just because a person's in jail does not mean they've committed a crime. It means that they've been accused of a crime. But county jails are primarily holding facilities.
True.
So this is what we're talking about here. We're talking about the San Francisco County Jail, I do believe.
Will references that Joe has said in the past that our troops live in hot tents in Iraq. So those people didn't break the law. So should our inmates be more privileged than our troops in Iraq?
Well, I mean, Joe made that comparison. The difference for that is that when people volunteer for deployment, they're free to go. I mean, for all practical reasons, the military owns you, but you can go and say, I don't want to be a soldier. I want to be discharged. And it's pretty easy to get out of the military these days. And you're provided recreation. You're provided access to your loved ones. You're provided internet access. You're provided a whole lot of stuff that you're not provided in jail in Joe R. Pyle's tent city. So it's not a valid comparison. And Joe R. Pyle is actually, I think he's going to try to make a comeback for sheriff next year. I think he's announced he's going to run.
Is that because the Senate bill keeps failing?
I don't know. I think it's probably because he's a certifiable nut. But he cost the citizens millions of dollars in liability. He defied federal judges' orders. He was found in contempt of court. He was convicted of contempt of court. He received a presidential pardon so that he didn't have to serve the sentence that was imposed on him. I mean, he's above the law. And I hope Will's joking, because I don't see any comparison whatsoever between a person who has voluntarily agreed that they will be deployed to be in conditions that are less than ideal than a person who is presumed innocent and taken into custody and is deprived of all the basic dignities of life. I see that as no comparison whatsoever.
I completely agree. I was just referencing what was actually said by the man.
So
spectacular human being. Yeah. Anywho. All right. Well, then let's move over to KUER.org, which is an NPR station in Utah. Hey, this is a second thing from Utah. Great. Prison saved my life. Utah inmates seeing new horizons with college coursework. Can you imagine the notion, Larry, that if you give people something while they're down, yes, they've made a mistake. Can you imagine that if you gave them training opportunities that when they get out, they could lead more enriched lives and potentially reduce recidivism? Can you imagine?
I put this in for that very reason, that we've got a relatively conservative state and we've got them being on the cutting edge of recognizing that education is the key. And it says, is it Senator Mike Lee or Representative? Anyway, I think Senator Mike Lee from Utah. Yes, Senior Senator Mike Lee is looking to bring back the Pell Grants that were the federal aid to people. There's a prohibition since the 90s, and he's looking at lifting that prohibition on Pell Grants and federal aid to people being convicted. So I think that's a great thing. So Utah is actually they've actually led the way, not only on this, but in terms of homelessness in Salt Lake City.
Of reducing or increasing?
Of reducing it. They have not stamped out homelessness, but they've come closer than any city of their size in terms of what they've done to aid and rehabilitate people that are homeless and get them off the streets. So although we gave them a little bit of grief earlier about that crazy statute, that doesn't mean everything that they're doing in Utah is crazy.
Certainly that. They say that there's only a handful of states that have some kind of course program. It's three lefties and a righty. So it's New York, California, Washington, and Illinois have college courseware.
Well, where's the righty of that?
Isn't Illinois more of a red state than a lefty?
I don't think so.
Oh, I thought they were. Yeah. Call me wrong.
No, they're a bunch of liberal do-gooders in Illinois.
Bastards! So why is it only the liberals that allow there to be courseware in while you're down?
Well, that's what I put this in here for. This is not the liberals. This is a very conservative state.
That part, yes. I was just, okay. So now we have one out of five.
Yeah. But see, the neat thing is conservatives don't get vilified for doing it. If you look at what President Obama tried to do in terms of ameliorating and he successfully reduced the federal prison population, not the state, because the president doesn't control the state, but he successfully brought down dramatically the federal prison population, particularly in his second term. But he got vilified for turning loose a tidal wave of crime. You don't get the same vilification when it's right, when it's conservatives doing it, because they're being fiscally responsible and they're doing the right thing. And you don't get the vilification from the left saying that they're turning loose a tidal wave of crime. So Mike Lee can get away with this because he's a conservative. And it works the other way on liberal causes. Only Bill Clinton could have signed the welfare 5-year limitation that ended welfare as we know it. If there had been a Republican in the presidency at that time, they would have been so vilified because they would have been throwing all these millions of people under the, which is what we did do. But since it was a Democratic president, the Democrats stood down and didn't criticize Clinton for signing welfare reform. They privately told him he was wrong. But so conservatives get away with being able to do criminal justice reform because they don't get vilified. They're never accused of sacrificing public safety.
And you've mentioned something like that before, that it takes a lefty to do a righty thing and a righty to do a lefty thing, right?
That is correct. If you look at it, it works that way in foreign countries. If you look at the path to peace in Israel, to the extent that we have peace between the Palestinians, it is the real conservative prime ministers that are able to pull it off. You may not be able to remember, but Camp David, we had Prime Minister Begin, who was the most right wing of all, who did the peace agreement with Egypt, because no one would ever have challenged Begin on security. And then less than a generation later, when you had the Oslo Accords with the Palestinians, where they turned the territories over to the Palestinians, that was Mr. Security, former Prime Minister Begin. Rabin. That was Rabin. Nobody would ever challenge Rabin's commitment to Israeli security because he was Mr. Security. But you let a left wing come in and do that. He got criticized when he pulled the Israelis back beyond there was a security buffer when they had invaded Lebanon in 82, and in 99 I think Barak withdrew from the security zone that they had been occupying for all those years. And he took enormous criticism because he was compromising Israeli security because he didn't have those credentials. So it's not an American phenomenon. It's that way in other countries as well.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
How about this New York Times article? It says how laws against child sexual abuse imagery can make it harder to detect. Did you get? Were you able to get through the New York Times paywall to read that one?
I was not, so I was going to let you lead the charge on this.
This one is so. If you and I are both working in forensics, you know, we have our big propeller heads on, and we are trying to figure out how we could make computer code that would figure out if an image were of a child in some sort of nudity kind of thing. We would have to transfer those images back and forth. Oh, wait, no, we've just committed a crime. So it seems the way that the article is describing it, that there are, I'm not saying that we should let people transmit images across, but if without being able to do things like, I guess, in a laboratory to try and figure out if we could make algorithms to detect it, that these things make it harder for anybody to try and come up with any sort of methods to detect the child pornography. It goes through a whole lot of technical stuff. I did pull it. It's in the document, but
I see it below here. Yes.
Yeah. I got it kind of late in the game for you though. I was like, hey, well, we could make some sort of, like, you know, we'll call it like the District of Columbia. We'll make an enclave where this stuff would be legal to do. Oh, wait, you can't transfer it there because you've transferred it out. There's no way inside of our legal framework for anyone to do any kind of research to figure out what could be done. One thing that has been done is once you have an image, you can make a signature of it so that the next time you see it, you can easily detect it. And I'm sure you don't want to go into the details of how we would get there. But then there's millions of new images that show up every year. And they have no way of detecting those without a human flagging them as being naughty images.
Well, the only thing I get out of this is you have no privacy on anything online.
Well, that's for sure.
There's powers greater than I can even begin to comprehend monitoring the images and probably the text of everything you're saying, everything you're communicating online. Would that be fair to say?
That is pretty close. Harken back to a couple segments ago where we were talking about the ubiquity of all the big internet companies, the Amazons, the Googles. They are watching everything you do. There's no worry in my mind of having one of these new the Echo things from Amazon in your house, because you're carrying around a cell phone that is beaconing out your GPS location. It's got a microphone and a camera on it. Like, you're leaking so much digital data. It's kind of irrelevant as far as your privacy goes, I think. You can do things to mitigate it, but you're kind of stuck.
So I'm leaking right now. So I truly am spewing radiation as I move around.
You are definitely spewing some radio waves for sure. And so, but back to something else you said about we have no privacy online. When you go sign up for a Google account and get Ashley, and you have the legal expertise to read it, they send you a 7,000 word user acceptance agreement that no one ever reads. And you've turned over all of your privacy information there. Places like Facebook, when you post an image, they own the picture. You don't own that picture anymore, which is, I don't know, you wouldn't really expect that that's what happens. And in some cases, not that this is related to our subject at all, but they will take that image and they will roll it into a marketing message. And it could be a picture of you and a friend of you sitting on the couch and you're having a cup of coffee or tea or something. And now you end up on a tea advertisement because you gave them a photo of you and your friend drinking. Just for your own personal use. And they turn that into something that's not at all what you intended, but you sign that user acceptance agreements saying that you let them use all of your stuff for their purposes.
Well, then you ought to refuse to sign that, by golly.
Yeah, you could totally refuse to use Facebook and Google and Amazon and all those things. It just, they have their tentacles so deeply entrenched into our lives. It's very hard, especially Google.
Well, I couldn't think of how I would get through the day without using Google or some search engine.
It's hard. It's very hard.
It's like, I don't know how you would do it. The society has evolved to the point where, what would you do when you need it? You can't look. I mean, imagine trying to look up something in a phone book. Well, when's the last time you've seen a phone book anywhere?
They still deliver them in my house, and I get very angry that I have to throw away this. And I live in a smallish town. It's not that big, but it's a pain. Stop.
Well, it doesn't have residential listings. I just about guarantee it has they here in 2013 they quit carrying residential publication, but they still do a business phone book. But try finding one. Try finding an Encyclopedia Britannica. When did they quit publishing those? Try doing research without Google. Try find. I mean, you just couldn't. You couldn't. So all of our legal research, we do it online nowadays. If you went to the law library, they still, last time I was over there, they still have the printed regional reporters. But if you were actually pull one off the shelf, that the dust cobwebs would I mean, there would be such a storm of dust that you probably wouldn't be able to breathe for the next several days, because no one does anything that way anymore.
So to work back to the article, they talk about a patchwork of different laws that have been created that make navigating anybody trying to figure out how to curb this, solve this, detect it, prosecute it, etc. It's incredibly hard. And then throw in, which I don't think they covered in the article, the technology side of being able to circumvent whatever technology they do have to detect it. I don't know how they're supposed to solve this problem without having humans involved, which requires transferring images for someone to flag them and say that these things are inappropriate, for someone else to then make some sort of arbiter decision that that's the bad pictures.
Well, it looks like you have one arm, if I glancing at the article, one entity working against the other, and laws that undermine the ability for you to actually do some things that might be helpful. Am I getting the gist of the article?
Yeah.
That it impedes the investigation because of the restrictions. So.
I would always end up struggling back, and I will avoid being graphic as much as I can. If you go to the beach, there is a lot of flesh showing, and I don't know how you could detect that ratio of flesh versus something that is not appropriate flesh. Like, I don't know how you can get there. Because you're talking about a very subtle, a very fine line between something that is a child wearing a bikini versus something far more sinister than that.
Well, I don't have the answer.
Yeah, I certainly don't either. I just don't know how you get there because, you know, even the Supreme Court said, you know, I don't know how to detect what is porn, but I would know it when I see it. Okay, well, maybe that is by your moral compass, but not by somebody else's moral compass. You know, people join nudist colonies, perhaps some super... conservative person would be, no, we can't do any of that. And then, you know, you have that whole varying spectrum, which I thought was part of the United States, was to be free to do those things. And this crashes right into that.
Well, by golly, we just ought to make it legal and quit even trying.
That could be a way to go. Hey, U.S. News and World Report says, a letter shows psychologist broke rules with Iowa sex predator. This married woman apparently wanted to get into It's like an emotional, like a verbal relationship with one of her patients. Seems a little bit sketchy to me.
It looks like it got beyond that. It looks like that he was alleged to have committed an act in her presence.
Correct. Yes. He may have self-stimulated, as a way to put it, to put it politely.
Yes. He appears to have done that. And she lost a $98,000 a year job because of her boundary issues. Now, what I took from the article is probably the opposite of what most people take from the article. Everybody's always crying for prosecution. Well, clearly, prosecution isn't the answer to everything. This is probably an adequate resolution. You've got a person who is supposed to be in a professional environment, administering treatment, and the temptation was beyond what was able to be within her zone of tolerance. The temptation was too great, and she went beyond professional boundaries. That doesn't translate magically to a crime.
Right? You could call it moral and ethical problems, but not a crime, right?
Yeah, it shouldn't translate to a crime. And what you do with a person like that is we talked about the teacher in Connecticut, I believe it was, that had the relationship with a 19-year-old that stalked her for the whole winter break until he managed to hook up with her. And because even though he was over the age of consent, that Connecticut could prosecute her. That prosecution was way over the top, as any prosecution here, which they haven't talked about any, just simply she got fired. But when you have this type of thing, you can't have it because it it undermines the therapeutic, to the extent that this therapy was actually going to have any positive outcome. You don't have a true therapeutic relationship when people fall in love. You don't have institutional security when you have someone who is trading secrets and breaking the rules. So you have a breakdown of all sorts of things when someone falls for a person that's in their care. So the right thing to do is to remove her, and that's what they've done. They've removed her from her $98,000 a year job.
But on top of that, though, like her husband works in a similar capacity, and he recently left his state job, and now the couple's Cherokee home is listed for sale. And I don't want anyone to know my whereabouts for obvious reasons, the woman said.
I didn't catch that part.
It's at the very end. It's at the last two paragraphs.
So I did a Larry read and didn't read it all the way.
That's what you get, man. That's what you get for skipping.
I don't want anyone. Yeah, so...
So don't get involved in a relationship with a patient, and then you don't lose your $100,000 a year job. Is that the short version of the story?
Well, unless there's any prosecution, but so far this article doesn't allude to any that there's going to be any prosecution. I hope there isn't.
You decided to put in a novel article from The Appeal, and then there's two or three articles that are the same thing after it. What does death by incarceration look like in Pennsylvania? These elderly disabled men housed in a state prison. We have people in prison that committed crimes a quarter century, half century ago, and they're still in prison. Maybe that's justified, but these guys are like hobbling around on canes and wheelchairs. And why? And there's even one picture of a guy that has the, I don't know what it's called, the nose breather thing, the oxygen tubes going to his nose. These guys are looking really rough with their orthopedic beds and so forth. It's crazy that they're still in prison.
Well, that's the reason why I put it in here. It's an article I'm going to use if my favorite representative on the Republican side in New Mexico brings back his three strikes law that he's so fond of bringing every session. And I have the conversation with him. I say, well, you claim you're fiscal conservatives, right? Right. Okay. What we know is that as people age, their ability to engage in criminality declines. So although you may be angry at them when they pick up the third felony at age 26, by the time they get older, they have aged out of that criminal behavior. So you're willing, as a fiscal conservative, if I got this straight, you're willing to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars because you're angry that they picked up three felonies by the time they were 27. And you want to pay for their medical care, and they're going to become increasingly expensive for us to take care of, because even though we don't provide a true hospital setting, geriatric inmates cost us more money because we have to provide medications at some level. We have to provide medical care at some level above an average inmate. We have all these devices that cost money. And we have extra security, so we end up having to have when you have a large number like Pennsylvania does, they have a couple of prisons that all they do is house elderly patients. Those prisons are very expensive compared to the regular prison because of all these extra costs. And I say, as a conservative, how can you justify doing this? And he says, well, it's easy. It's the law, you know. It's the way, you know. It's they had their chance, and they don't deserve to continue to get chance after chance. I say, okay, well, let's give them life without parole. I'll go along with you on that, if you will give a safety valve at some point they can get out of life without parole, where it's automatic. They don't have to go through, because in Pennsylvania they have to go through this parole board process, and this article alludes to, since Governor Milton Schaap was in office back in the 70s. That all the combined administrations since him have only granted a fraction of the relief that he granted during his governorship. So I tell my conservative representative, if you'll provide a safety valve where we'll just automatically release these people when they get a certain age and certain medical ailments, that they'll just default out of prison and they'll go into a supervised setting. Oh, no, well, we can't do that. I said, well, then I can't support your bill. But I don't understand how the citizens are so willing to spend this level of resources on someone who poses so little threat to society, by all accounts.
Yep. And we have a similar article over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Why 1,200 people who never took a life are condemned to die in Pennsylvania prisons. So these are, I guess this would be like three strikes stuff where you get convicted of three drug crimes. Could that be some of these people?
Well, I think this one is the, now that I clicked on one, Arkansas. I think this one is where people committed second degree murder, but it's the same as they can get the same sentence.
I did jump ahead of you by accident. Yeah, you go to the Arkansas one, a life sentence in Arkansas and a lifetime of pain.
So, okay. That one was as the legally, totally, not legally, but the totally blind person who's like 72 years old and, mm-hmm. and all of the requests for clemency have fallen on deaf ears.
She was an abused wife and even had left at one point, and then through pleadings of her husband, she returns and he's beating the crap out of her, raping her, etc. And she's beating him with the pistol and the pistol goes off and she gets, she's been in prison for quite some time then.
But apparently the parole board in Arkansas has recommended, but the governor has not granted I don't understand.
I don't either.
The current governor could, because he's not seeking any higher office. As far as I know, he's done the pinnacle of his career. He's serving Congress and he's governor of Arkansas and he's getting up there in years. I don't think he has any other aspirations. But will he? Well, we'll see.
Yeah. And if you want a bunch of statistics and data and stuff, there's a final article that the Philadelphia Inquirer has that I was mentioning just a second ago. There's a bunch of data charts and how many people are spending, how many years in prison and so forth, and how much money it costs, et cetera. So,
well, that was the one where the total commutations by all the governors after Shapp was only a fraction of what he did. So the hoping that the system that they have in place will make an individual determination to let these people out, never going to happen.
I think we should close the show out with a article from Reason Magazine that's West Virginia inmates will be charged by the minute to read ebooks on tablets. I can't think of a better way to generate revenue out of a prison for having someone read Moby Dick five times and charge them for every minute that they're reading that book five times.
Well, this is your capitalism. Now, you are a staunch capitalist. This is companies like GTL and various businesses who invested Global Tel, like that's GTL.
Correct.
These are companies who have offered to buy the equipment for the prisons, to buy the tablets, and to make these books available. And I know that you wouldn't want to stand in the way of free enterprise working. Now, would you?
This, to me, this is unconscionable that we would do this. The thing that we would want more people in the country to do, particularly I don't want to focus it that way, but like everyone in the world should read more, not less. And to punish people for wanting to read a book this way just seems unconscionable to me. And then for the state to sign on and make it a revenue share model where they're... Pennsylvania also pays a private contractor $4 million. No, that's to digitize the mail. There was something in there where it says that they will get a kickback from it. I forgot how much it said. It says, in addition, the 5% commission will go towards a fund of each prison's inmate. So that's part of their revenue stream, that they're going to donate 5% of that money to go to inmate welfare projects.
Well, now, people out there, Andy, working, paying taxes, and a lot of them can't even afford tablets for their kids, and you are wanting to confiscate the wealth of the taxpayers to give it to these people who break the law, who had a choice about what they did, and you want to provide them free access. I mean, what comes next from your side? What is it that with you people, you just want to hand out money like there's no tomorrow?
While I am like Mr. Digital, like don't send me paper for anything, I do find that reading a book it's far more convenient to read a paperback book than it is to do it on a tablet generally. Obviously for size purposes, it's way better because you could have 1,000 books on a tablet and it takes up the same amount of space. But so here you have libraries that are probably shutting down from lack of use because everything's moved to the internet. Well, what do you do with all these books? I know. Donate them to prisons. Nope, not doing that. We want to have tablets in the prison so that we can charge per minute to read a freaking book that's 100 years old in the common, in the public domain. This is terrible. This is terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
Well, I'm just disappointed that you don't see the virtues of capitalism at work here.
I don't see that this is beneficial to anybody.
It is beneficial to the companies who have been innovative, who've put their hard-earned money, invested it, JPay and GTL. These companies have invested their resources and been creative. I thought that's what America was all about.
Do you think then you can get whatever publication you want? Do you think that you can get, I don't want to go down the Penthouse Letters avenue, but could you get just something of a controversial book? Like even, I think they push back on having a book like Twilight, that whole series in there, or maybe the Harry Potter books. So they've provided it to you and you're paying per minute. Should they then not be able to censor what you read?
I hadn't thought of that. But on a serious note, I have the same concern you do. I think that if we were thinking rationally, we would want people reading books. And we would want people to do it in a way that's collections of books are security hazards. They can be used for a number of things, including bonfires. And it would seem like to me that it would be in our interest as a society to have better managed prisons, to have people using technology. It would seem like it'd be better to have people using emails because they can be monitored.
Yes.
And they can be scanned more easily. It seems like to me that we would be embracing the digital age and be moving away from as much print as we possibly could, just for a number of reasons. I don't understand why that they want to build the barrier of charging people. But I can tell you what happened. That when you want to set up a program like this, you're talking about upfront cost. And trying to figure out how to fund the upfront cost is kind of how we got into having the largest privatized prison. The largest percentage of any state's correctional beds are under private control or here in this state. And the reason how it happened is that we decided that it was easier, rather than using our precious capital outlay to build prisons that don't have a lot of support for. When you go out and build capital facilities for most anything else, whether it be senior citizens or schools or whether it be hospital, whether it be a new bridge, whatever it is, library, you have a ribbon cutting and there's a lot of community support and pride. You don't have that same level of support for building prisons. So we brought in the private prison operators here and we guaranteed them a level of occupancy and a level of per diem that they could count on in exchange for their capital outlay. Now we have a perverse system here where it's in our interest not to have our prison population decline beyond a certain point because we are on the hook for paying these companies who put their capital outlay, who used their private capital. And that's what happened in this case. Outfitting all the prisons in Virginia, West Virginia, was going to cost a whole bunch of money. And that capital outlay had to come from somewhere. And this company raised their hand and said, oh, well, we've got the perfect solution. You won't have to invest any money at all. We will provide the equipment. And all we want is a small cut. That's all we want. And that's how it happened.
Isn't this also, you know, someone that gets store goods, you know, I was fortunate to have be provided for while I was gone. So this wouldn't necessarily impact me. So maybe I get one or two less soups or more, depending on how much I wanted to read. But the people that don't make store call, that don't, like, are they provided some kind of waiver, but they keep going in the hole deeper and deeper? That seems troubling to me.
It's not clear in this article if this is a privilege that if you have the money. I mean, again, it stands to reason in a capitalist society. I mean, people get all torqued out of shape. It would stand to reason that to the extent that prisons allow variations, whether you're allowed to spend $65 a week or $115 a week or whatever they allow, it stands to reason that those who have the $65 or $85 or $95 a week maximum that they can spend, they're going to have more than a person who has nothing on their books. Well, it stands to reason that a person who has the ability to pay this fee, they're going to have more access than an inmate who doesn't have anything at all in his books. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure that out unless they make an indigent provision. And there again, who's going to pay for that?
Discriminatory to me.
Of course it is.
It feels further like kicking the person that has fewer resources to saddle them with more challenges.
Well, what's the solution to it? Do we can't tax anybody?
No, we certainly can't tax anybody. I wanted to bring up one other thing that I was thinking about. I don't know if you ever spent any time in the hole, but you're only allowed to have so many books checked out from the library to begin with. So when you're in the hole, they'll ride around with a little cart, and you can then pick three books from whatever's left from all the other people's grubby paws picking books. And then people start swapping books around. And, you know, because if you're in the hole, you can read for 16 hours a day. You can knock out some books. You know, you could knock out two or three books in a day. Now, what are you supposed to do for the rest of the week? Are you going to start tossing tablets around?
Hadn't thought of that either.
Yeah. So there you go. Do you have anything else that you would like to cover this evening?
Well, I'd like to know about when you were in Vegas. Tell me about your shower experience.
Hold on. A, I didn't go to Vegas, so I have no experience, and I'm trying to reference something that you may have told me about a shower experience, and I don't recall a shower experience. Do I have Alzheimer's?
Yes, I had a shower experience in Vegas.
Tell me about your shower experience. So, did it involve a shower head?
It does. I had my shower head with me, and I at the Planet Hollywood, they have largely every room I've ever stayed in. I'm assuming it's all throughout the hotel. They have stand-up showers. They also have tubs, but they don't. The tubs are not equipped with a shower, so you have this nice deep tub you can take a bath in, but they don't have anything overhead. So, but in stand-up, they have these tile floors, so I do what every traveler I know does. I took off their piece of crap shower head and put on mine because theirs doesn't let any water flow through. So I juiced it up and had all the water flow I needed. But after about two and a half, 3 minutes, the base of the shower stall had filled with water, and so therefore I was not able to use my shower head because my shower head's letting so much water through that it was backing up. But when I put their little puny shower head on, no water was, and there was no backup. So I was in a conundrum. I couldn't call maintenance and say, come fix my drain, because if you were to turn on the shower and let it run for 10 minutes with their little puny head that had a little stream, there was no backup at all. So they'd say the guy's certifiable. And then I'd have to say, well, look, let me see, show you what happens when I put my shower head on.
I do remember the story now, and my apologies. I do remember.
So I had my beautiful shower head, and I could not use it. I had to use their little puny thing because, of course, I could have requested a change of rooms, but that's always a lot of work after you've set up all the crap I carry with me.
Yeah, no doubt.
So I'm stuck in this room where I have to use their low flow shower, and I had my beautiful shower head, but it was of no use to me.
Larry, Captain Showerhead strikes again. That's all I got to say.
Well, I'm telling you, if you'll just ask the TSA, everybody carries a shower head with them.
I think someone sent me a picture of an x-ray of somebody going through TSA, and there were like 75 shower heads in their suitcase. That wasn't you, was it?
No, but it's a normal thing to do.
Normal. 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 Yeah. That's a very relative term.
I can't think of any reason why a person wouldn't carry a shower head with them.
Well, feel free to email or post comments on the episode and tell me what you think about if you travel with a shower head or not. And where would people do that at the website, Larry?
Yeah, registrymatters.co.
And maybe they would like to phone in their opinion about using a shower head, and they could leave some voicemail. Where would they do for that?
Well, now that's going to be a different story if they want to phone in, because nobody does that anymore. But if anybody out there were to feel inspired, you would call 747-227-4477.
And if they wanted to send that email message telling me their story, their life story behind, please don't send me a life story about your shower head usage, where would they do that?
Registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And of course, if you would actually like to tell me your life story, there is a place that you could contribute in a way that we would be compelled to allow you to tell your life story. Where would they do that?
Oh, that would be at patreon.com.
Perfect.
And you can search for or just hit / registry matters, and you will be able to do gross or net or any amount of a dollar or more per month. And so far, we don't have any takers on the gross or the net yet.
I think that's true, though. I think some of our people are so far down on the totem pole as far as income goes, they might be doing gross or net, which is unfortunate. I don't mean to say that in any sort of like condescending tone. It's just sad.
But the very nice patrons that we have, thank you again, as we always appreciate.
Very much. This is the last episode before Thanksgiving, correct?
It would be. We'll be recording, I'm guessing, 2 days after Thanksgiving next week.
Very good. So let us wish everyone a happy Turkey Day, gobble gobble. And I hope everyone has safe travels and see your family and friends and everything is well for you.
So, well, and thank you for having me again.
I appreciate it very much. And please extend my best wishes to Ashley when you see her again. And with that, Larry, have a great night and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.